thinking about Henry David Thoreau today. Henry David Thoreau still resonates with different people in different ways. To some, he is an early environmentalist, a defender of wilderness. To others, a great writer, inspiring his readers to ask hard questions about a life worth living. To Maine's Penobscot tribe, Thoreau was one of many searchers who came to Maine, hired native guides, and learned from them. To many activists, he is one of the heroes on the very idea of civil disobedience. A new film about Thoreau explores all these aspects of his life and his lasting impact. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, we speak with the filmmaker and two scholars about how Thoreau's life and writing continues to influence people today. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. This Thursday evening, Maine Public Television will broadcast the documentary Henry David Thoreau, Surveyor of the Soul. Today, we'll be discussing the life and legacy of the American writer and philosopher. With me in our studio, Huey Coleman. He's a filmmaker, the filmmaker who made the film we're talking about, also the founder of the Maine Student Film and Video Festival, which is now in its 40th year. Also in the studio with me, Kristen Case. She's an associate professor of English at the University of Maine Farmington. She's published articles on Thoreau, Robert Frost, and Ezra Pound. She is the author of American Pragmatism and Poetic Practice, Cross Currents from Emerson to Susan Howe. And joining us from our Bangor studio, Darren Ranko. He is an associate professor of anthropology and coordinator of the Native American Research at the University of Maine, Orono. Thank you all for being here. And as always, we want to hear from you and the audience. What questions do you have about the life of Henry David Thoreau? How do you think of Thoreau today? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Huey, a remarkable accomplishment. And it strikes me, watching this film, that you've been working on it for a long time.
Yes, this had a long production period, definitely the longest of all my films. If I put it all together, it was 13 years.
What happened 13 years ago to start this journey?
Well, I finished a film called Wilderness and Spirit, a mountain called Katahdin, obviously about Katahdin. And Maine Public, in fact, showed it during that time, 2002. And I usually spend a year trying to figure out and touring the film. And because during that film, one of the early climbers of Katahdin was Henry David Thoreau, I said, I've already met a lot of the people. I've had a lifelong interest, well, since college in Thoreau, and so why don't I do it? So I got started, and that was in 2005, late 2004. In 2005, I did some interviews, which you actually see in the film, Howard Zinn being one because he passed away before I restarted. But as these things go, as an independent filmmaker, funding ran out. And so in 2006, I had an opportunity to make a film on Marion McPartland, the jazz legend. So I spent, you know, 4 or 5 years on that and then restarted up. So I still kept, you know, thinking about it. But that's one reason why it took so long.
Well, one thing I learned from the film and the way you just spoke reminded me of it. You say Thoreau as though I'm making a Thoreau film about. Why do you pronounce his name that way?
Well, in the I knew this could be a point of contention, but it's not a big deal. Say, pronounce his name the way you would like. But if in the very beginning of the film, you'll see J. Walter Brain. Walter Brain was a wonderful man. He's passed away since the filming, but he talks in a very kind of upbeat way. And what he says is, in Concord, that's how the people pronounced his name.
In Concord, Massachusetts. So that's how his family would have pronounced it.
Right, right. And one written thing is Nathaniel Hawthorne, who I think Kristen or others could verify, wrote, I met a new person, a fellow today. His name is Thoreau, rhymes with furrow, as in the furrow in a garden.
So, Darren and Kristen, I want to bring you into the conversation. You were both interviewed in the film, and you both come at Thoreau from different perspectives. Darren is a member of the Penobscot tribe, a great nephew to one of Thoreau's guides, and Kristen is an English professor. And Darren, I'll start with you. How is Thoreau remembered in the Penobscot tribe, if at all?
Thanks for the question. It's a really honor to be on the program with you this morning. He is remembered, I mean, which is remarkable, I think, considering that it was, you know, the mid-19th century when he was there. I think I was kind of brought up or heard the oral traditions from different people regarding Thoreau, and it's a complicated relationship. And I think, you know, he himself in the book, The Maine Woods, he has, you know, Penobscot guides at each of his trips to Maine in the 1840s and 1850s. And he kind of evolves. This is one of the most interesting things for me over time is that I think early on he was sort of seeing Indians through a very colonial or sort of almost racist perspective. You can track some of his language. But by the end of his time, he's actually forming relationships and starting to understand what another point of view in terms of the things that he really deeply is concerned with, you know, nature, wilderness, how people engage it. And he's starting to understand, I think, a different cultural point of view by the time, as you mentioned, my great-great-uncle, Joe Polis, was his guide in the 1850s. And I think his relationship with Joe Polis in particular, I'd like to see it as sort of transformative for him, and that he was getting out of the bubble of a sort of more typical 19th century white guy investment around how he saw Native people. So I think it's a really interesting story from a Penobscot perspective to see him, you know, wrestle with us as people and kind of come out a little bit better than he might have if we just had his first couple of writings about it.
Sure. And in just a couple minutes, we'll run a clip from the film where you're talking about that. But I want to bring Kristen into the conversation as well, though. And Kristen, we'll have a clip of you in the film as well. But before we go to that, I just want to ask you sort of broadly, what is Thoreau's place in American literature?
Oh, wow.
Just a big one right off the top.
Well, it's a great question, and thanks for inviting me to be part of this conversation. Thanks, Huey, too, for making this beautiful film. I think Thoreau's place in American literature can be approached from a lot of different directions. I mean, on the one hand, you can look at him as, with, I think, Emily Dickinson and Whitman, as sort of being part of a very pronounced emphasis on the first person in U.S. literature. So that kind of experience of the self that we put right at the heart of the American literary canon, I think Thoreau speaks to that. I say it the old way. I say it Thoreau. I've never been able to change. I think he's a really important figure from that perspective. But I also think that Thoreau allows us to kind of think about language in some really interesting ways. There's a kind of complexity to the way that he uses words where you're able to, I think Walden can be read as a personal experience, and it can also be read as a book of philosophy and many other things besides that. And so there's always a kind of multi-leveled experience for the reader. And I think that's a really rich function that it holds in the canon of American literature as well.
And Huey, it strikes me that this is really what you wanted to get through with the film, that Thoreau has entirely different meanings to different types of people.
Yes. That's, and hearing Kristen talk, that's what's amazing about it. He just was one of these. And I think some of us living in Maine and other parts of New England remember these people that are unfortunately, you know, not as round with us as much as times go on, but they sort of looked at everything. They didn't just say, like, I'm only going to study this, I'm only going to do this. Thoreau was a handyman. He could build anything. So he had these natural engineering instincts, which led to his work with the family pencil business. He was a writer. I think many people, I remember coming to Maine in the early 70s and meeting farmer poets, you know, who are, you know, much older than me, you know, and because they lived close to nature and looked at the world through, you know, wider eyes perhaps than I did certainly at that time. He was also, firm on his, political beliefs in terms of, that one night in jail that, resulted in his essay on civil disobedience. And he was a great observer of nature. He was, in the early people understanding ecology, how all this in nature entwines and seasonal changes. So he was, a vast person. And the other thing I wanted to do was I felt there was a humanity to him. Having made portraits of artists, I always approach in my films with Marion McPartlin or Todd Webb or others how to, show the humanity of the person. And I wanted to do that with Thoreau. And, of course, that's a challenge for somebody who's been dead 150 years.
Well, and to your point that he was a handyman and he was skilled in engineering, the film's title is Surveyor of the Soul. And surveyor, quite literally, he was an expert surveyor.
Yes, he started off first, in my understanding, and Laura Dossal Walls, who wrote a biography of Thoreau, was the lead scholar and major consultant, with teaching. He had a school. He was teaching young people. And he was an early proponent of what we would call field trips and hands-on learning. So to learn math, they did surveying. And also when he was at Walden Pond, as Patrick Chura in the film points out, the first thing he did before even writing the book was survey the pond. So he had an interest in it. It was also a available occupation of the time. And so he was definitely a surveyor, as some people said, a morning surveyor and an afternoon seeker. And so through that, I took the title and I hoped Henry would like the pun on soul and soil, if surveyor of the soil or surveyor of the soul. So I'm sure
he would have. I teased that we would run in some clips from the film, and let's do that now. We'll start with Darren Ranko. This is from the film.
I'm Penobscot from Indian Island, Maine, and my great-great-uncle is Joe Polis, who was one of Thoreau's guides during his last trip to Maine. The overall narrative in the Maine woods, read from a Native American or Penobscot perspective, is an interesting one in that we see Indians differently through the three trips that are described in the Maine woods. The first trip, we see a lot of almost missed opportunity. Thoreau has a lot of ideas about who Indians can or should be, and they tend to disappoint him. And he says that the church is the only trim-looking building, but that is not Abenaki. That was Rome's doings. I even thought that a row of wigwams with a dance of powwows and a prisoner tortured at the stake would be more respectable than this.
Darren, that's you. When you listen to that now, what do you think?
Yeah, it's always a little shocking to think of, this person who we're generally like praising. I think Thoreau is a really important thinker in American philosophical and environmental traditions. But to have him, I feel like I'm the one disappointed now, right? He was disappointed in my ancestors back then, and it's kind of disappointing to hear him, fashion someone at the stake being tortured, and somehow that fills in for, a more authentic Indian experience for
right.
him. It's a really interesting disappointment for me listening to his words, 160 years later.
Well, somehow the idea of idealism, being idealistic about something that really is not something that the people you're writing about would agree with it all.
Well, I think
absolutely. And go ahead.
I was just going to say one reason I approached Darren was I felt the Penobscot perspective was important exactly for this reason, because often scholars sort of skip over that part. And Darren being a scholar and Penobscot, and when I found out he's related to Joe Polis, I said, "Wow, this is the right person." Certainly is to bring awareness to that. And as, I don't know if Darren talks now, but as he does about the other chapters as well.
Okay, another clip.
Yeah, no,
go ahead.
No, I just think, there is, and getting back to your initial question, for me is that not just scholars. I mean, other people in the tribal community know Thoreau's writings about us. You know, I think that's one of the things that it's a pretty common thing for people to know what he wrote about us and be disappointed from the Penobscot Nation point of view, but also knowing this sort of transformational part of it, toward, you know, as it develops as a set of relationships over time.
So, and I'm trying to put this in the right words, but I want to ask you, Darren, what you think about the idea that Thoreau is so famous for espousing a lot of the ideas that were sort of just intrinsic to Penobscot life. Like, I'm sure that Penobscots reading Thoreau, reading Walden Pond or other writings say, no duh.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is, you know, an important, again, like, he's very selfish in the first two trips, or his writing comes across as, like, I want this singular experience, me as the author, the singular experience with nature or the wilderness, and want to be challenged by it. And this is a kind of universal experience. And I think that slowly gets transformed into something like, as you're alluding to, there might be other people who have had this relationship with the thing that I care so deeply about, that might be more akin to what I'm looking for. And actually, maybe I should talk to them and not just, you know, prefer them to be roasting someone over the fire. You know, I think that's the transformative moment that is really important for Thoreau.
We'll go now to a clip of Kristen from the film.
The things that he asks us to examine about our lives and our culture and our hard questions. And I think he could be relentless in insisting on asking those questions. I also think people held him in great affection. And that seems clear, the stories of his death and how absolutely grieved the whole community was by his death. I see him as a very connected person, not at all a disconnected person.
So, dispelling some of the myths that in some ways that Thoreau was an outcast or a miscreant, not at all the case.
Yeah, my students are always surprised if they know something about Thoreau. They're always surprised that he was only at Walden Pond for 2 years. They think that, you know, he was like a hermit who lived there forever, and that he actually had a very busy and engaged social life, not only before and after his time at Walden Pond, but during his time at Walden Pond. And I think Laura Dessau Walls in the biography, and Huey also in the film, does a really great job of dispelling that myth. And there's a long tradition of people pointing to Thoreau's social engagement at Walden as some kind of hypocrisy. But actually, I think, you know, it was very much key to his project. I think it was in many ways a project of solitude, but in other ways a really essentially social project. He wanted to, brag as lustily as Chanticleer in the morning to wake his neighbors up, is the epigraph of Walden. And I think, like, neighbors and thinking about his neighbors is right at the heart of that idea and his whole endeavor there.
We're talking about Henry David Thoreau. The new film about Henry David Thoreau, Surveyor of the Soul, will broadcast this Thursday evening on Maine Public Television. I want to note that we will be talking about President George H.W. Bush on Wednesday. If you have a memory of the late president you would like to share, we encourage you to leave us a voicemail. The number to call, 207-370-3487. Again, 207-370-3487. That's for Wednesday's program about the life of President George H.W. Bush. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, more on Thoreau. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Maine Masonic Charitable Foundation, supporting Maine Public Radio's efforts to provide knowledge, wisdom, and entertainment to the people of Maine. And BCM Environmental and Land Law of Northern New England, helping landowners, farmers, and governments problem solve. NHLandLaw.com. And Freeport Wild Bird Supply, a destination for bird enthusiasts for nature gifts, feeding supplies, and guided tours. FreeportWildBirdSupply.com.
Hanukkah. It's one of my favorite times of the year.
Mine too. The holiday commemorates the rededication of the old temple in Jerusalem, and it's also a symbolic representation of the strength, the resilience of the Jewish people.
Hanukkah Lights celebrates the occasion with stories of the season. I'm Murray Horwitz.
And I'm Susan Stamberg.
Please join us for all new stories on Hanukkah Lights from NPR.
Tonight at 7 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio. Our Maine Public Classical Holiday Stream is up and running and will continue until mid-January, providing a quality, commercial-free, public radio-style, 24/7 holiday online stream of the many wonderful sounds and diverse interpretations that make up the well-known and not-so-well-known sounds of the holidays. The Maine Public Classical Holiday Service is available on the Maine Public app or online at our website, mainepublic.org. Just click on Radio and listen live. It's one of the choices and enjoy whenever and wherever.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, the life of Henry David Thoreau. Joining me, Darren Ranko. He's Associate Professor of Anthropology and Coordinator of Native American Research at the University of Maine. Kristen Case is an Associate Professor of English at UMaine Farmington. And Huey Coleman is the person behind a new documentary about Thoreau that we will broadcast this Thursday evening on Maine Public Television. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. On the line with us now, Lucille Stott. She is from Brunswick, Maine, and is the author of the book Saving Thoreau's Birthplace, How Citizens Rallied to Bring Henry Out of the Woods. That was just published last month. Lucille, thanks for giving us a call.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me on.
So tell us about your book. How did you get the idea?
Well, in fact, I love how Dewey's film, and I also love the conversation I've just been hearing, because I got the idea because I started working with the Thoreau Farm Trust, which is a nonprofit that incorporated in 1998, to save Thoreau's birthplace from destruction, raise the money to have it rehabilitated. It had been privately owned until 1995 and then went on the market that year. But it's interesting to note that, as Kristen said, most people think of Thoreau as having lived at Walden Pond all his life, and that he somehow made a claim to hermithood, which exactly, you know, is a terrible misrepresentation. So the book and the whole project to save Thoreau's birthplace is to bring him out of the woods and relocate him in the town that he loved, in the town where he was a very busy citizen. So the house is meant to symbolize that. He was the only author, actually, associated with Concord who didn't have a house in Concord. Louisa May Alcott has Orchard House, and Ralph Waldo Emerson has a house. Nathaniel Hawthorne has two, but none of them was born in Concord. Only Thoreau was, and he did not have a house that represented his entire life there. So we thought that was very important. And on his 200th birthday in 2017, which was celebrated at the birthplace last summer, I realized that although the historic structure report about how the house was physically restored had been documented, no one had told the story of the people who had saved the house in the first place. And so I thought that was an important story to tell.
Great. Well, I know you've seen the film. What was a highlight for you?
Well, the highlight, actually, because I now live in Maine, was the time, was the Penobscot episode. I just loved seeing, knowing the fact that Thoreau had come several times and that he had engaged with his guides who had changed his attitude. I just loved that part. But I also just loved the whole approach that Huey had through the entire process that he went through. It was a long process to make this film. He really wanted to delve into Thoreau's whole life, and he saw him as a whole person, the way Laura Odessa Walls did in her biography, as Kristen said. And so the whole approach really drew me in and kept me there. And, of course, I loved the fact that Laura Walls's interviews and some other scenes in the book were filmed at the birthplace, the restored birthplace, which, you know, is dear to my heart.
Well, Lucille, thanks so much for calling into the show today. That's Lucille Stott, the author of Saving Thoreau's Birthplace, How Citizens Rallied to Bring Henry Out of the Woods. We'll go to a call now from John in Bath. Hi, John. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Yes. Thanks, Jennifer. I just wanted to recall from one of his writings in the North Woods when he was with, I believe it was Joe, the Native American guide, that they had traveled up Moosehead and all through the North Woods, and then they came back down the Penobscot River and back to Indian Island. And I believe it was just before they got there that he asked the guide, Thoreau had asked the guide, if he was looking forward to being home and going home. And the guide replied that I'd never left my home. So that always struck me. And so I just wanted to relate that and also tell you, Jennifer, I'm not sure what they're paying you at PBS, but it's half what you're worth, and you're doing a great job.
Well, thank you very much, John. Oh, you know, and you're going to be happy to hear that the story you told is in the film, isn't it, Huey?
Yes, Darren should speak to that, but that was obviously important. I discovered that, too, in Wilderness and Spirit, the idea that the, you know, the Penobscots or whatever Native people, white people encountered were, you know, in the wilderness. No, they were in their home. Darren, you mentioned that at passage in the film.
Yeah, absolutely. And I want to point out, too, that there are still Penobscot guides, and the trip that is documented in the film is, you know, Penobscot guides leading, you know, to a certain extent, a recreation of Thoreau's journeys in Maine. And it's I think that connectivity too, that now as then there are Penobscot guides connecting to places and people, is one of the things that I think as a tribe, as the Penobscot Nation, we're really proud of and feel kind of that this is our homeland and this is our territory. And the exact quote, and I agree with the caller, it's a really fascinating quote. It's because it's right at the end, and it's kind of shocking in the way that the words are put together. And actually what Polis says is after Thoreau asks him, are you happy to be home? Basically, Polis says, it makes no difference to me where I am. It's all my home. And that was one of the questions you kind of see as lingering from all the trips and all the writings, is he keeps asking people, like, what is it like, you know, to be at home in the wilderness? Or what is it like to be at home here? And I think Polis really, makes that dichotomy, or attempts to make that dichotomy disappear for Thoreau in profound ways. And one of the other things that we noticed very early on is that, you know, at the beginning of the trip, Thoreau understands that Polis actually reads the newspaper every day, so he's also literate, which is one of the things I think, you know, between the wild and the civilized, you know, being literate was one of these big divisions that with Polis also Thoreau had to let go of.
Kristen, you note that Thoreau was sensitive about not, or not, maybe not sensitive is not the right, but aware that maybe he was a little awkward and a little still coming to terms with his relationship and his feelings about Penobscots.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a really thorny question, and I'm so glad that we have Darren here to talk about it, because I think it's, you know, people, as with many different issues throughout Thoreau's life, you can sort of cherry pick the journal to build whatever case you would like to build about Thoreau's relationship to Native peoples, about, you know, on many issues. But I think it's a complex one, and as Darren is pointing out, there's an evolution there. And I'm so pleased at the way the film dealt with that question by not having. By asking the Penobscot their view, and that was the gesture that the film makes that I think is so important to our consideration today of Thoreau's relationship to Penobscot people. That conversation has to include the Penobscot.
Darren, how common was it in the early 1800s for somebody to come up from someplace like Massachusetts and hire a Penobscot guide? Are we talking dozens, hundreds, thousands of people?
I mean, there are people probably more expert than me to have done the documentary history on it, but it's, you know, it's somewhere in that dozens to hundreds. You know, once, and you can see this along, there are guides, you know, if people come through Bangor, you know, then as now, you know, Moosehead Lake was a really popular destination. Getting there could be a little bit more challenging than it is today. Once, you know, the town of Eden, which becomes Bar Harbor, and other places along the coast start to get set up. Even there on the coast, Penobscots and Passamaquoddies were offered their services as guides so people could, you know, see wilderness. I mean, the 19th century, the idea that someone from Massachusetts could take a steamer or New York to Maine and then be in the wilderness within a day or two and have this sort of experience with a native person guiding them through this, you know, experience, I think was a really profound one that was an ease of tourism that really started in this time period. So definitely as this, you know, to serve tourists primarily, it was always to kind of like that experience of being a native guide. And then also just because oftentimes these were the people who knew the most about these places.
And speaking of a journey and a change of perspective, Huey, I want to ask you, how has your perspective on Thoreau changed in the 15 years since you started this film? What did you think going in that you no longer think?
Well, no longer think. That threw me a
curve
at the end.
Or think differently.
Well, probably there's some things. I should say that from the beginning, I wanted to definitely tell the story of Henry David Thoreau, but unlike most biographies, I wanted to, of historical figures, I definitely wanted to make it very much today. So I wanted to have the impact of Thoreau's writings and lifestyle today. So that's why it was key to have, you know, the Penobscot people speak today, and many others. You know, Thoreau had so many impacts, you know, in the environmental movement, the civil rights movement. You know, Martin Luther King wrote about Thoreau in the film. You hear from Howard Zinn, Bill McKibben, Representative John Lewis, you hear him give an excerpt from an inspiring speech. So that I and there's a wonderful section that a lot of people pull up on is the Walden Project in Vergennes, Vermont, the students that spend 4 days a week the entire school year, and we know what it is to be outside in winter, in northern Vermont, studying Thoreau and being inspired, that program by Matt, run by Matt Schlein, so that all of these important things today. So one thing I did find out was I didn't know about the Walden Project. I had an inkling about the connection to the, well, I knew about the connection to the Penobscots, but people still eloquently speaking today, like Darren and others in the film, from the Penobscot Nation, and then, you know, the Walden Project, and Richard Primack from Boston University, who's using climate change studies of Walden Pond today based on Thoreau's observation from 150 years ago. So that's probably what I learned, is the amazing amount of people still connected and tuned into Thoreau.
Well, we have a great email from Beverly, which I know you're going to love, Huey. In the midst of holiday Black Fridays, judging people on the basis of what they own and display, and in the age of Siri and Alexa, how can Thoreau be seen as very relevant in today's society?
You want to start with that?
Sure. I mean, I guess I will say that I think the really profound question that is asked, or one of the really profound questions that's asked in Walden, is what we mean by the word necessity, which we use all the time very cavalierly. And I think that, you know, for my students, for myself, every time I read the book, every time I engage with it, really asking that question, when, you know, I have to do this, I have to do that, I have to go pick up my dry cleaning, I have to get a new cell phone, you know, and then really interrogating the way that we use those words and what we mean by necessity is, I think, just a perennially important question for us to ask, not only individually, but also collectively. And the reader's excellent, or the listener's excellent email points to the way that I think that question has, you know, only increasing relevance to
our lives. On the other hand, though, Huey, He liked technology.
Yes, he was. He was a master, surveyor, and he kept up on the latest surveying techniques. He also invented a state-of-the-art machine for sorting out graphite. Henry Petrosky, who's a part-time Maine resident and wrote the book The Pencil, talks about that. And the Thoreau family pencils were considered some of the finest, if not the finest, in America. And he invented the machine and he also did the accounting and selling of that. Bob Sullivan, who's in the film, says that Walden helps us to understand and get away from the distractions, Siri and Google and all of this. And I also, with my students, I do teaching. At SMCC, they'll love my 40. They have to go 48 hours without media for no cell phone or anything for their midterm. And they also, I have them read chapter 2 of Walden, which is the chapter where Henry went to the woods because he wished to live deliberately and not when he died, discover he had not lived. And I say to him, when you're old and, hope you live long lives, but you're on, are you going to look back and say, oh, gee, I spent, half my life talking to Siri and the other half surfing cat videos, or do you want to find out? And I think when you speak to young people about, deliberately live your life, why are you here? Why, the essential questions that Thoreau asked, I think speak to them today.
Well, you mentioned Bob Sullivan. I think he's calling in, but we have to go to a break. So Bob will get to you after that. Also, I want to have a word about tomorrow's program. We are going to talk about enrollment for health insurance under the Affordable Care Act. In time for the December 15th deadline. So if you'd like to call in or send in an email ahead of time for that program, feel free to. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do InSource Renewables, committed to providing renewable energy solutions that support Maine's communities, workers, and the planet. InSourceRenewables.com. And Federally Law, dedicated to providing effective counsel on all matters of land use and real estate in Maine. Learn more at FederallyLawMaine.com.
I'm Greg Dalton. On the next Climate One, we explore documentaries on coal miners, corn farmers, streetlights, and solar flights.
It's the big jump into the adventure, into the exploration.
With insights from the filmmakers.
Our film is really about neighbor versus neighbor. We never wanted to make a David versus Goliath kind of story.
Films for the holidays on the next Climate One.
Coming up shortly after Maine Calling at 2 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
Thanks for all your feedback over the years and your suggestions, too. Hi, this is Sarah Willis. The one thing I've felt really badly about is not being able to satisfy your requests for more music and at different times of the day. Well, that problem has been solved. Visit mainepublic.org whenever you want, anytime, all the time, and click on Listen Now. You'll find a new choice at 24/7 InTune online stream. Hope you enjoy it.
And welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling today on the program. What you may not know about Henry David Thoreau, my guests are three people connected to a documentary that will be shown Thursday evening on Maine Public Television. Huey Coleman is a filmmaker, and it is his film, Henry David Thoreau, Surveyor of the Soul, that will be shown this Thursday. Kristen Case is an associate professor of English at the University of Maine, Farmington, and has published articles on Thoreau, Frost, Ezra Pound, and is the author of American Pragmatism and Poetic Practice, Cross Currents from Emerson to Susan Howe. And Darren Ranko is an associate professor of anthropology and coordinator of Native American research at the University of Maine, Orono. If you'd like to join our conversation, our number 1-800-399-3566. Robert Sullivan's on the phone with us now from Philadelphia. And Bob, you called in right as Huey was talking about you. Thanks so much for calling in.
You're welcome. I mean, thanks for having the program. And my ears started to buzz when he said that. Yeah.
Hi, Bob.
This is a lot of fun to listen to you guys. I often stream radio stations in Maine, because I just imagine myself there, even though I'm not there sometimes. But I was just really listening to Professor Ranko. I enjoyed, of course, hearing all of you guys talk.
But since I got to be in the film, thank you very much. I'm so excited to see it. When are you going to play it, Philadelphia?
Well, send me your address so I can send you a DVD. You're a star in the film, Bob.
I don't believe it. I hope not. But the, since the film, you know, in hearing him, Professor Ranko, talk about how his views maybe change of the Penobscot of Native Americans. You know, when I wrote my book about Thoreau, I had a lot of fights with friends who are scholars of Irish American history. I try not to write about the Irish, given that my name's Sullivan and I might get out of control. But they were all saying to me, "No, Thoreau says these horrible racist things about Irish immigrants in Walden," and it's true he does. But when you go to the journals, you see again that his kind of mind and his view of Irish Americans changes. And one of the things that brings me, you know, further in thinking about this is that of course he's writing when Irish Americans or Irish people are coming from Ireland because of a famine, and it's basically a colonial enterprise that gets them out of Ireland and sends them to America. So part two of this, of thinking about this, is subsequently I've been writing a lot about the American West, and the best coverage of the Irish famine, of people having no food in Ireland because of government policies by the English, the best coverage is by the Choctaw and Cherokee press. Presses started up after many of these people were moved to the West, frankly, as we know. And I think, and their coverage is just the sharpest coverage of the famine. I think these two things are really closely associated, and I think Thoreau's somehow in there, though I haven't quite figured it out yet. But the second part is, and it's much shorter than the first thing I just said, is that that's where the book itself, Walden, becomes like your cell phone. Are you going to use it, as Thoreau used to say? Do you use your plants for a good thing, or does it use you? Likewise, you can read Walden and think, "Oh, I got to go get a vacation home, and just be out in my vacation home all summer." Or you can think, "How can I reimagine space?" For me, it's a spatial book, and then that gets us back to him. If we go where he seems to start to go, maybe I would agree with Professor Ranko. If we go where he seems to start to go, and we read Walden, now a person like me who's raised in New York City and told that Native people were just once in a while there, but as he gets older, if you're me, realizes that it's the most Native space, the estuary of New York, that it's being built, as I'm a teenager, by iron workers who are Native Americans. This is what Walden can do. And so I think of a book like The Common Pot by Professor Brooks, I think it is. But this helps people reimagine space. I've said too much.
Bob, well, thank you for calling in. Kristen, did you want to weigh in?
Oh, no, I was just nodding furiously because that was such a great comment. I mean, I think the idea of using how we use books now, particularly books from the past, is such a vital and important question. And I think Bob is exactly right that Walden opens for us all kinds of questions that allow us to question not only our own culture and our own endeavors and practices, but also Thoreau himself. So Walden gives us the authority to question him as well as ourselves.
Darren, before we move on, anything to add to that?
No, I think that's a great set of connections. And I would just add simply that, you know, I think Thoreau being so famous, and we kind of think of him as, you know, Walden with his most famous work. But it's great to see someone, you know, not in their 20s, but someone, I don't know the exact timing of when these things were written, but in his 40s, you know, transforming his beliefs or his understandings of things is probably one of the great things we can say, oh, well, that's actually what we aspire to do, is to not just fix our belief systems when we are in that particular time. And he's constantly challenging himself to know better and see better. And I think that's also a great lesson for Thoreau.
Thank you. And we're going to go to Larry calling from Bangor. Hi, Larry. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm part of the generation that, as a junior, we all read The Transcendentalists, and we read, in particular, Emerson and Thoreau, and we all were assigned civil disobedience. And, you know, it became part of our lives, obviously, because you can see all the protesting we did. The students nowadays know nothing about uncivil disobedience because it's not taught. It's not taught because the Texas School Board took it out, and the Texas School Board has an amazing amount of power as to what textbooks are used in America.
Huey.
And that's a good section of the film, too, is obviously on civil disobedience. And I would argue, and I'm sitting next to a scholar here, so I got to be careful, that Thoreau's probably most famous and many ways most influential work is his essay on civil disobedience, which was originally called An Essay on Civil Resistance, because it's worldwide impact. I mean, Gandhi read it. It wasn't the only reason that Gandhi started nonviolent protest, but it had to lay that seed into his brain. And Martin Luther King has direct quotes about Thoreau and how important he was to his development in the protest movement. And yes, it probably still, you know, it should be taught. Thoreau, of course, when you read him, he's, you know, writing in 19th century language. So you have to work a little hard to get there. But I was watching a Coen Brothers the other day, and they always have these people talking in weird 19th century dialects. So they're popular filmmakers. But anyways, Larry brings up a very good point, and that we should know this, and that's why in the film Howard Zinn is in there, you know, who wrote The People's History of the United States, and he talks about the civil disobedience. And Bill McKibben, and you know, there's many civil rights issues from Black Lives Matter to gay rights and transgender and also environmental. You know, these are all kind of our protest of today. So I think they're out there, but in terms of organized teaching, he's probably right.
Thanks, Larry, for your call. A message from Greg. Just want people to know that there's a Thoreau stamp available in local post offices and online. Also, I'm interested in hearing more about Thoreau's role as an abolitionist.
Okay. Well, in the film, one thing as a filmmaker, I can't be an expert of all, so you surround yourself with very good people like our guest today with Darren and Kristen, but also Spencer Crew, an African-American scholar from George Mason University, is probably one of the leading historians on abolitionism and the anti-slavery movement, is interviewed in the film. And he talks about, about abolitionism. Thoreau wasn't a joiner. I mean, he said he wasn't, you know, he's an independent thinker in all aspects of that. He, you know, didn't go to church, but he's probably in many ways one of the most spiritual people you can read, and many people would attest to that. And he never really joined abolitionism, although Sandy Petrolinus in the film points out the importance of the women around Thoreau and in Concord, Mass. You have the Thoreau sisters, Sophia and Helen, and his mother, strong anti-slavery proponents, set up formed a society, anti-slavery society in Concord. Lydian Emerson's wife, was there, and they were always kicking Ralph, you know, Waldo and Henry to get to these meetings and make a point. And so we discuss that in the film, and we also hear about John Brown, which brings up a whole other thing, because John Brown was a violent proponent for civil rights of the enslaved. So all of those things are discussed in the film and are still very much important today in our society.
I just wanted to add that that's another really important place where we see Thoreau's evolution, I think, is in his political thought, which gets increasingly radical over the course of his writings, from civil disobedience and slavery in Massachusetts to the writings on John Brown at the very end of his life. And also, I think that trying to see in one frame his environmental thinking and thinking about place and thinking about nature and his radical abolitionism is a really compelling project that lots of scholars, too many for me to name, but James Finley comes first to mind, are working on that exact intersection.
We'll go to Will, who's calling from Cornish. Will, we're almost out of time, so if you can be brief, that'd be great.
Very brief. I spent 7 years in a yurt. That season started off with an interesting experience where, as I approached the end of the driveway of the property I was going to spend the next 7 years on my bicycle, which was my transportation at the time. A vehicle is coming down the road at me with a license plate that says Simplify. Over the years, Thoreau resonated with me, particularly the beginning of one of his chapters where he started off, I purchased a nail.
Well, thanks for coming. Go ahead.
Yeah, and he proceeded to write the rest of his chapter with that as his theme. So he was amazing. The film sounds great. Thanks for your program.
Thank you. Yeah, we talk, you know, simplicity, of course, is key and ties in with a lot of things. You know, our lives are so cluttered and the distraction and you know, sorting out what's really important in our lives, I think, is what Thoreau was really trying to get us to do. And there's a societal concern in there as well. Spencer Crew in the film feels, you know, if you don't act against what you feel is unjust, are you creating a prison for yourself? And, you know, taking off of Thoreau's line, under a government which imprisons any unjustly, the true place for a just man is also a prison. That's a pretty serious thing to consider. So he, Thoreau, on one hand, could describe wonderful sunrises and sunsets and what, you know, the robin was doing and the loons and but on the other hand, he really asked some fundamental questions that we all should face.
Well, thank you for your question. And Huey, I'm going to end the program with a very short question. This is from Beth in an email. Will the new Thoreau documentary be able to purchase on DVD?
Yes, you can go to filmsbyhuey.com and get it. It'll also be part of the pledge drive, so you can support Maine Public Television and get a DVD as well.
Well, thank you all for being here. Really, I was able to see the film this morning, and you will, I promise, you will learn a great deal if you're able to catch it Thursday night on Maine Public Television. Thank you, Huey Coleman, for being here, filmmaker and founder of the Maine Student Film and Video Festival, which is now in its 40th year. The film, Henry David Thoreau, Surveyor of the Soul, airs on Maine Public Television Thursday night. Kristen Case, an associate professor of English at UMaine Farmington, and Darren Ranko, associate professor of anthropology and coordinator of Native American research at the University of Maine, Orono. Sandra Harris ran the board today. We had additional help from Rich Tozier in our Bangor studio. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and by Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, answers to your questions about signing up for the Affordable Care Act. And another note, we will be remembering President George H.W. Bush on Maine Calling on Wednesday following his funeral. And one other thing, at long last, the 7th annual Maine Calling Made in Maine gift guide is now available. Visit our website or Facebook page to check it out. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.